Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Steve Squires. Squires is a professor of astronomy at Cornell University. He was the principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover mission and has written a book about this project entitled Roving Mars, Spirit, Opportunity, and the Exploration of the Red Planet, published by Hyperion Books last August. Welcome to the show, Steve.
That's nice to be here.
Listen, you were an undergrad studying geology at Cornell in 1977 when you enrolled in a course about Mars, and it changed your life.
Yeah.
Tell us this story.
Yeah, it really did. I had started off as a geologist. I got into geology because I liked climbing mountains and I liked doing science, and I thought it was a way to get paid to climb mountains, basically. and I enjoyed geology, but I was looking for a place that no one had been. I mean, a place that really no one had been. I wanted a blank spot on the map. I wanted a place where there was nothing. And, you know, geologists have been studying this planet for hundreds of years, and they've done a pretty good job of figuring it out, actually. So I enrolled in this course. This was 1977, I think.
That's
more or less. And it was when the Viking mission to Mars was active. And Joe Vavirka, who's now the chairman of the astronomy department at Cornell, was a member of the Viking science team. And he taught this course on the results of this mission to Mars. And I thought that sounded cool, so I signed up. And because it was a graduate level course, I was an undergrad, but he let me in the course. Because it was a graduate level course, we were expected to do some kind of original piece of research for our term paper. And so one day I went into this room that they called the Mars room, where they kept all the pictures from the spacecraft. And I figured I'll sit down and I'll flip through some pictures for a few minutes and maybe come up with an idea for a term paper. And I went in there and I started looking through those pictures, and it was just a revelation. I didn't understand what I was seeing, but the beauty of it was nobody understood this stuff. Uh-huh. Nobody had seen it before. I mean, literally at that point, probably only a few dozen people on Earth had even seen these pictures.
Wow.
And all of a sudden I realized, here's that blank canvas that I've been looking for. And I walked out of there knowing exactly what I wanted to do the rest of my life.
Oh, that's amazing. How lucky you were.
Yeah.
Now you've persevered for almost two decades trying to get this Mars project off the ground.
Yeah.
You got rejected, personnel changes. And what kept you believing in this?
It was a combination of things. You know, it was 16 years from the initial concept to when we actually had hardware on top of the rocket at Cape Canaveral. Part of it was just a rock-solid belief that if we could make it happen, it was going to be something really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just always believed that, and that was part of what kept me going. To be honest with you, you know, once it was 6, 7, 8, 10 years into it with nothing to show for it, basically, at that point. A big part of what kept me going was simply fear.
Really?
Really fear that if I quit now, a decade of work, a decade of my career, basically, would have been wasted. And I just didn't want to let it go. I'm stubborn.
I'm just real stubborn. But I could feel the emotion in your book as you took us through all the steps and all the rejections, and
it was a long
sitting
road.
In hotel rooms and getting these phone calls and emails. And,
yeah, it was
wow,
a long road.
Yeah. So when you finally did get the okay, what were some of your original goals for this mission?
Well, the goal from the outset, I mean from 18 years ago all the way up to the present, has been to find out whether or not Mars ever had conditions that would have been suitable for life. Right now, Mars is a miserable place. It's cold, it's dry, it's desolate. It's not the kind of place that life would like.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have found was that in the past, you know, billions of years ago, it was a very different world. It was warmer, it was wetter, there was liquid water at the surface, there was an environment that would have been suitable for life. And that was what we set out to find out many years ago.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about how frightening and beautiful and violent a rocket launch is, and that even you as a scientist are amazed that it actually works. I find that wonderment amazing from you.
Well, you have to see it. I mean, you watch a rocket launch. You ever seen a rocket launch?
Not live.
No, I mean, it is a totally different experience live than on television. It is just a completely gut-level different experience. When you see it on television, you don't get a sense of the violence of the event. A couple reasons. First of all, the sound just isn't the same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it doesn't have that shaking your chest kind of feel that you get when you're close to a big rocket that's lifting off. The other is that you don't get it because the camera sort of tracks with the rocket, and it almost looks like it's going in slow motion. You know, it's you don't get a sense of how rapid, how violent the acceleration is. Another thing is that if you really want to realize how violent and nasty a rocket launch is, you should see the tests that we have to put our hardware through. I mean, every piece of hardware that we launch has to be shaken violently.
And how do you simulate that?
There are these shaking machines. It's great big shaking, you know, the hardware shaking machines. And what they do is they simulate the vibration of a launch. And it's a terrifying thing to watch because you build this hardware, say a camera or a spectrometer, and you spend millions of dollars on it and you lovingly take care of it and you baby it. And then you got to take it into this laboratory and bolt it to this table and shake it so hard. You can almost hear your hardware scream. Screaming for mercy as it's being shaken on this table, and you realize that's what's going to happen on top of the rocket. So it's a very violent process.
You have to keep that
process
in mind when you're building things,
yeah.
Right?
You have to design the stuff for every environment that it's going to face. But yeah, rocket launches are—it's amazing to me that they ever work. Really, they're just—it's just such an incredible process.
Yeah, and it must be—it's amazing that human beings have been able to withstand that kind
of
thing.
The rockets, you wouldn't want to strap a human on top of the rocket that we launched on. There are some special launch vehicles that have been designed specifically to carry humans, and they tend to have gentler accelerations than some of the stuff that other rockets will subject hardware to.
You know, you talk about how that there was only a small window of time in which to launch.
Yeah.
The rovers in regard to the planet's alignment and stuff with Earth. To talk to us more about that.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't go to Mars anytime you want.
It
literally is driven by the alignment of the planets. In order to get from point A, Earth, to point B, Mars, the two planets have to be in just the right positions relative to one another when you launch. And they're always moving relative to one another. And what happens is there's about a three-week window of time. The last one was the one that we launched in was in the summer of 2003. And you got to hit that launch window. You have to go off in that 3 week period. And if your hardware is not ready to go to Mars, then the next opportunity to go comes 26 months later. Now, the other thing to realize is that at the peak of this project, we were spending about $1 million a day. Weekends, holidays included. We could not afford, NASA could not afford, the nation could not afford to have us miss that launch date and then just kind of keep going until 26 months later. Now, we wouldn't have spent $1 million a day for that whole 26 months, but it was not financially possible for us to miss our launch window. Either we launched in the summer of 2003 in that three-week launch window, or we didn't get to go to Mars at all. That was it.
And you had kind of some hairy moments there when things were going wrong. And
We were trying to develop some spacecraft that could do things that had never been done before. And anytime you're doing something that's never been done before, there's no place to go and look up how to do it. You know, you got to just figure it out. And when your parachutes are ripping, when you test them, and we land with airbags to cushion the blow when we hit the surface, and when the airbags are bursting when you test them, you just got to fix it. I mean, you just got to find an answer, and you don't have time because the launch window is fixed. It's driven by celestial mechanics. There is nothing more absolute in nature than that. It was scary.
Yeah, and you could feel it in your book when you were talking about all those problems tweaking that you had to do. and because solars because rovers are solar powered, you have to land at certain spots.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how you decided where to land these things.
Well, the first rule is you got to land where it's safe. Okay, if you don't land safely, you don't do any science at all. So the first rule is you got to land someplace where the rover's going to get down successfully and be able to operate. So that means several things. First of all, it's got to be near the equator. As you mentioned, the rovers are solar powered. That means you need to have the sun overhead. It can't be down low in the sky. And so we had to land within about 15, 20 degrees of the equator in one hemisphere or the other. Another thing is you got to land low. You can't land on a mountaintop. You can't land at high elevations. And the reason is we use a parachute. Now, a parachute uses drag through the atmosphere to slow down. And if there isn't enough air between you and the ground, your parachute's going to be going too fast when you encounter the ground and you have a very bad day and you wreck your spacecraft. So you have to land low, you have to land near the equator, and you have to land in an area that's basically smooth and flat for the most part over the entire area where the vehicle might come down. Once we looked at the whole planet and imposed all those rules, we came up with about 150 different places where we might land.
Really?
And then to choose two from those 150, then the next thing was the science. Mars is a very complex place, very diverse geology. Some places are fascinating. Most of the planets, pretty boring from a geologic perspective. Mm-hmm. And so what we've tried to do is to pick two places where there seemed to be evidence that there might once have been water. And the two places we picked were dramatically different from one another. One place, it was the composition of the rocks and the minerals on the surface that said maybe water had been there. The other place, it was a big hole in the ground with a dry river flowing into it. We thought maybe there was a lake there. And what we did was we chose two places that were very different so that if Mars faked us out, okay, if we were just flat out wrong about either of those places, then maybe the other one would come through for us instead.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but it was tough to choose. It was really tough to choose.
Uh-huh. And to talk to us a little bit more about what the rovers were actually built to do.
Yeah, sure. The rovers are robot field geologists. Okay, a geologist is like a detective at the scene of a crime. A geologist is looking for clues. Anytime a rock forms, it will preserve in its composition, in its nature, something about the conditions when it formed. If you have a stream that's carrying sediments and it drops those sediments in a lake, the coarse-grained ones will settle close to shore. The fine-grained one will drift further out. So if you find, just by looking at the grain size of a rock, you can tell something about where it formed. If water evaporates away and it leaves salts behind, you can look at the composition of the salts and find out what was dissolved in the water. And there are many, many, many other examples like that. So the rovers were designed to find rocks on the surface of Mars just as a human geologist would. Be able to go over to them, you know, look off into the distance, find something interesting, go over to it, and then study it in detail using all the tools that a geologist would have with them in the field, plus instrumentation that a geologist would only have back in their laboratory. Mm-hmm. Bring all those tools to bear and read the record in the rocks, read the clues, and read the story that the rocks have to tell about what it was like on Mars a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And that's what their job is.
Because a lot of people just think about these rovers as sending back photographs.
And they send back some spectacular photographs. I mean, I love the pictures.
Yeah.
But the pictures are only part of the story. They're an important part. It's what we built the rovers with 20/20 vision. They have 20/20 color vision. Those pictures are just what you would see if you were standing there on the Martian surface. But we had to give them other capabilities as well. They have infrared vision. They have an X-ray spectrometer. They have a gamma ray spectrometer. They have all these different devices. They have a microscope for looking at the rocks really in exquisite detail, mm-hmm. and telling us what they are made of and what stories they have to tell.
You became very close to the rovers.
Oh, yeah.
You talk like a proud parent. Yeah.
I still am.
And you said that tears came to your eyes when you saw the first rover crawl.
Yeah, I did.
You know, so sweet.
You try to be the kind of steely-eyed space explorer dude, but, you know, it was so many years between the initial concept and when you actually see your ideas rendered in front of you in aluminum and silicon. And then when you see it come to life like that, you know, after so many years, it was a very moving experience. And then what happens is you grow ever closer to them as the process goes on. Launching them was funny. It was a strange feeling when mm-hmm. they launched, because I had expected when they launched this just to be this kind of joyful moment. Yes, our rovers are finally on the way to Mars. But it was hard to say goodbye. You know, I'd worked mm-hmm. so hard for so long with so many people. We got a huge team, and we all worked so hard together to make this happen. It was really hard to let go when we sent them off to Mars.
And then you were probably afraid for their safety. So
I was very afraid for their safety. Yeah, and I still
father.
Am every day. I mean, we just had a bad dust storm on Mars right next to the Opportunity landing site just this past week, and I was really worried about that.
Huh. Which are you closer to one than the other?
No, not at all. I always say I love my children equally, but they have very different personalities. They've developed extremely different personalities. We built them to be as identical as we could. But even when they were babies, even when before we launched them, they had very different personalities. Spirit was our firstborn. Spirit was the first one, and it was the troublesome one. Every test that we ran, we seemed to run on Spirit first. And the first time you run a test, it doesn't work. So Spirit, we would have problem after problem after problem. And then by the time Opportunity came along, a few weeks later, and we had run the same tests, we were smarter, and we'd learn more, and Opportunity would perform better. So even in the beginning, it seemed like Spirit was the problem child.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Steve Squires. We're talking about roving Mars, Spirit, opportunity, and the exploration of the Red Planet. This is such a fascinating story. The rovers were supposed to have lasted for 90 days, right? That's
crack
up.
That's what we said. Yep, 90 days. Today is day 656.
That is amazing. So tell us more about what we've learned from them, because we knew a lot about Mars prior to this.
Sure. The primary thing that we've learned is that long ago, particularly at the Opportunity landing site, that was the landing site where we got lucky. Mars was a habitable world. Liquid water was beneath the ground and soaked the rocks. Liquid water came to the surface and evaporated away and left salt deposits behind. Mm-hmm. And liquid water actually flowed across the surface. We have found ripples preserved in the rocks for billions of years that clearly show that water flowed over the surface here. These are the clues that we went to read. Mm-hmm. But it was not... You know, it was warm, it was wet, but this was no evolutionary paradise. We've learned some other things too. For example, the water was nice, pure water. It was sulfuric acid.
Ooh.
And let me paint a picture for you what this place would have looked like mm-hmm. billions of years ago. Imagine a place, it's dry most of the time. Okay, there's water beneath the ground. Actually, there's sulfuric acid beneath the ground. The sulfuric acid comes up to the surface and it evaporates away and it leaves these sulfate salts behind. When it evaporates. And then the wind blows these salt deposits around and forms big dunes. And now in the low spots between the dunes is where you get the pools of water. And the water, the acid, it's so acid that as it flows through the ground, it probably dissolved out chemicals, dissolved out iron-bearing minerals, and it came up to the surface. It was probably a ruby red color because it had so much iron dissolved in it. So picture these ruby red pools under a pink Martian sky with sand dunes piled up all around, and the dunes are made of salt. That was the kind of place that it looked like. Now, you can go to places on Earth that are like this. You can go to places on Earth that are dry, that the water is sulfuric acid, and they're teeming with life. Life is able to survive mm-hmm. in those kinds of environments. Whether life can first arise from non-living material in that kind of environment, we don't know. But it was a habitable place.
Wow,
a strange
that's
one.
Amazing. Because we always hear the old adage, if you find a planet that had water, then you can usually... deduct that there might have been life there. Or
might
be.
Have been is the essential phrasing, though. No one has actually found
right.
evidence for
yeah.
life yet. The cool thing about this place, though, is that the kinds of mineral deposits that you see there are the kinds of deposits that are good at preserving evidence of life if it ever existed.
Ah.
So if we can actually go to a place like this and bring back some rocks and put them into the best laboratories on Earth and take them apart, we might be able to find out what was in that water.
Wow, that's amazing. So these were supposed to be alive for 90 days, and
yeah.
we've had much, much more time.
That's right.
Is it giving you more time to do more stuff,
yeah.
or was the 90 days
no.
set up to be it?
90 days was when the warranty expired.
Right.
Okay. When NASA funded us to do this mission, they wanted I don't know if a guarantee is the right word, but they wanted assurance that the hardware that we were building was going to be good enough to last for some period of time. And after a lot of thought, 90 days was what we settled on. Now, I'll be honest with you, I thought we were going to last longer than 90 days. Mm-hmm. I thought we'd get 120, maybe 150 days. There's no way I expected we were going to last this kind of length. What has happened is, well, first of all, we built good hardware. I mean, we built good solid hardware, and what that meant was that if we somehow got lucky with the conditions on Mars, it might last a long time. The thing that we thought would kill the rovers was dust mm-hmm. on the solar panels. Mm-hmm. They got these great big solar panels that collect solar energy, and they can get dusty. Mars is a very dusty, dirty place, and we thought that would end the mission. For hundreds of days on the Martian surface, we saw a buildup of dust, and Spirit in particular was almost dead. I mean, we were just about on our last dying gasps with Spirit, but then what happened was we got into the season of the year when it's windy on Mars. We didn't know this
oh.
going in. We had no idea what would happen. But we climbed up it. We managed to make it all the way to a mountain range, climbed up onto a ridge crest because we thought the geology would be interesting there, and we got hit by some gusts of wind, and it cleaned off the solar rays. It was like taking it to a car wash. And within a matter of like just a few days, the power output on Spirit was as good as it had been the day we landed
wow.
because of these gusts of wind. And we've experienced several – we call them cleaning events. I don't know, what are you going to call them, right? But, but we've experienced several cleaning events now on both rovers. And as a consequence of these, they have just lasted far longer than anybody expected. As of November 19th, 2005, we will have been on Mars one full Mars year, which is almost two Earth years.
That's just amazing. Yeah. So what will kill them? Will it be the same thing?
I don't know. We thought it would be the dust. It still could be, I guess. But if it's that, it's a long ways off because they're both pretty clean right now. You know, there are a couple things that could happen. These things have a lot of moving parts, a lot of gears, motors, you know, things that can wear out. And in fact, we've had some components wear out already. But, you know, if parts wear out, there are things that you can do. We can, we got six wheels. Okay, if one of those wheels seizes up, we can drag it. We can actually drive dragging two wheels. If the steering motors seize up, there are different ways to steer the vehicle. So we have lots of tricks that we can play. The one that worries me most is that we'll have some kind of electrical failure. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of electrical components in these things, and it's almost a pure single-string design. In other words, there's very little redundancy. Now, we have the ultimate redundancy in that we have two rovers, of course.
Yes, and they're both still alive,
and they're both
amazing.
Still alive. So, you know, one could die and the other one could last for another year, for all I know. But it's, you know, it's like if your laptop, some component in your laptop dies, well, you just call the manufacturer and you get a new motherboard and you fix it. We can't do that with ours. And so there are many components that if they died, bang, that's it. You know, one morning the rover just wouldn't wake up and you'd never see it coming. And so it's hard because you don't know how long they're going to last. And so how do you plan? I mean, we have to have a plan that makes sense for where we're going and what we're going to do a month, a year, 2 years into the future. But at the same time, every single day, we've got to drive them like there's no tomorrow, because that could be the reality. And I go to work every day wondering, did the rovers die last night?
Wow, that must be an emotional seesaw.
It is, but it's not as bad as it used to be. You know, we nearly lost Spirit on the 18th day of the mission. We had a terrible, terrible problem that developed on Spirit from like days 18 through 20 of the mission, and the vehicle nearly died. And if they died young, if they died early in the mission before they'd achieved what we set out to achieve with them, that would have been real hard emotionally. Oh, that would have really torn people up. As it is right now, they've done so much more than we could possibly have expected, that when they do die, it will be an honorable death. And it will be a hard day. I don't want to fool you. I mean, it's going to be really, really tough emotionally, but we'll be real proud.
How will you know? How much time would you give them to re-respond or
You know, it
break
sort of depends
silence.
On what kind of clues we get as to what's going on and how they die. I mean, one way they could die is parts just wear out to the point where we just can't drive them anymore. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we'd just say a sad goodbye and turn them off. Mm-hmm. But the other possibility is just one morning, we don't get any data. We've had that happen several times. I mean, that happens to us occasionally.
Yeah.
And every time it's been something benign or something that we can fix. But one of these times, maybe, come in one morning, no data, and then you'll just keep trying, and no data, no data, no data, and you realize, that's it. And you'll never see it coming if that's what happens.
Yeah, yeah. who's monitoring now? Do you still have a huge team working on this?
We have a pretty big team. The team's not as big as it used to be, simply because we've gotten so much better at what we do. My team, the science team, is about 150 scientists spread all across the United States and Europe, professors, people with NASA, graduate students, postdocs, undergraduate students. We've got a lot of people on the science team. And then there's roughly an equivalent number of engineers, about 150 or so, all of them working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. JPL is where the rovers were built. It's sort of where mission control is for operating them. And all the engineering work is done there. And we sort of just all function together as one big team, but kind of distributed across the country.
Wow. Is NASA getting antsy about having to pay for all this continuous?
You know, actually, they've been really NASA's been really great about this. The mission cost $850 million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and something like $800 million of that was spent before we even launched them.
God.
So the money, the investment has already been made. The cost of operating them now is peanuts compared to what it costs to build the things and launch the things and get them to Mars. And so the return on investment just gets better and better and better the longer you drive them, because it costs almost, you know, nothing compared to operate them compared to what we cost at the beginning. So, no, NASA recognizes a good investment when they see one, and their support has been unwavering. It's been nice.
That's great. You know, you're a trained astronomer, and you've studied the heavens. Do you think we'll ever find life on other planets?
I don't know, and I actually try not to form an opinion on that subject. And I mean that very seriously. Here's what I mean by that. I mean, what we do is search the planets for evidence of habitable environments, for evidence of life. And if you think you know the answer, if you think you know what the answer is, or think you know what the answer should be, or you want a certain answer, it's one of the worst mistakes you can make if you're a scientist. Scientists have a saying, I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it.
Mm.
Okay, you don't want to fall into that trap.
Yeah.
Okay? You want to, rather than developing an opinion, do I think it's out there? Do I think I know the right answer? If you're a scientist, a better approach is to say, let's build a better experiment and go find out. And so I try to maintain an open mind. And so my honest answer is to your question is, I don't know, but I want to find out.
Yeah. But are you a proponent of more manned flights to planets?
I'm actually a big fan of human exploration. People find that surprising because, you know, I'm a robot guy.
you don't seem like a robot guy.
Well,
for real.
I love robots, though. I mean, building robots to explore the planets is what I do, and I think it's a great way to explore. But I really firmly believe that the best exploration, the most successful exploration, and the most inspiring exploration is ultimately going to be done by humans. It's going to be expensive. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of money. It's going to be dangerous. And so using robots now, during the time when we're not quite ready to send humans yet, is an appropriate and cost-effective way to go. But I really, really, really want to see humans on Mars someday.
Mm-hmm. You want to see them on Mars specifically,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Why are you so interested in Mars?
Mars stands alone among the planets as a place that is Earth-like enough that you can imagine life taking hold there. The inner planets, Mercury, Venus, way too hot. Then you got the gas giants in the outer solar system. Mars is different. Mars is enough like home, enough like Earth, that you could really imagine life taking hold there. And so that's what makes it special for me. Now, there are a few other places, particularly some of the moons of the giant planets. There's a moon of Jupiter named Europa.
Mm-hmm.
It has an icy crust, but there's a lot of evidence suggesting that it may have an ocean of liquid water underneath. And that makes Europa a very intriguing place. Problem with Europa is, you know, it's really far out, and this ocean might be under, you know, miles of ice.
Hmm.
So to explore that ocean, you need a submarine that could go down through miles of ice and then get. So I don't know how to do that. And the rovers on Mars, I know how to do. So that's part of why I'm focused on Mars right now instead of Europa's. At least it's an achievable goal.
Yeah. So what's next for you? I know you're still working on this project, but what's coming up for Steve Squires after this? Do you have anything?
Number one is we drive these rovers until they die or we do. We have to drive them right to the very end. Number two is a rest, a long rest. After that, NASA has this ongoing program of Mars exploration. There's an orbiter that's on the way right now. There's a lander mission that's going to launch in 2007. There's another big rover mission that's coming in 2009. I'm personally involved in several of those at a much lower level,
uh-huh,
which is how I want it.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm looking for is a chance to participate in other missions of exploration in the future in a role where I can bring my experience to bear, where I can have a lot of fun, but a lot less responsibility.
Steve Squires, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
I enjoyed it.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.